Welcome to this episode of the Orville Universe Podcast. Today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 12, Mad Idolatry. What is the role of religion in a society? Should the Orville have some kind of prime directive? And which one of the Matthews would you rather base a religion on?
All that right after this. Definitely not me. Welcome to the Orville Universe Podcast. My name is Matthew Carroll.
I'm Matthew S. Fox.
What's up, buddy?
Not much. This has become one of the better parts of my week, so I'm always always excited for us to record together.
Yeah, man. Same here. Same here.
Especially because I will say the last couple episodes were, you know, we slogged through them and we found some good things to talk about, but they were not our favorites, I think. Certainly not mine.
For sure.
This may be my favorite episode of the first season. Certainly it's in the top three, and I'm real excited to talk about it.
Yeah, same here. I think of the ones we've watched so far, this is like one of the tightest stories. It's got a lot to dig into, like you just said, and it's really, really good and well done and well told, I think. And there's definitely things you can kind of disagree with the sort of resolution of the episode, but I think that it does a lot of cool sci-fi work.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And it does that stuff we're talking about. You know, it raises interesting questions, and it, as I'm sure we're going to probably get into somewhat today, it doesn't answer them. You know, I think there's a ways to the issues that this episode is dealing with, both about religion, but also about like how much do you interfere with other societies and how do you do that. I don't feel like the writers had the answers to them. You know, I watched this episode and I feel like the writers are kind of saying, we're not sure about this, so we're going to kind of think about it with you for a while and throw it all out there and let you figure out what you think.
Hmm. Interesting. I feel like they do kind of take a stance. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know. We can definitely dig in deeper into what they do and don't say.
Right.
But how about we get to that summary real quick?
Sure, go for it.
We'll dive into that. Kelly, or Ed, the story begins with Captain Ed Mercer wandering around the ship trying to find someone to hang out with. He attempts to hang out with a couple of his crew members. They all are busy. Then he goes and hangs out with Bordas, and they end up impaling his hand with a rousing game of Latchkum. It's really, really great. Really, really great gag. And then he ends up going to his first officer and ex-wife to spend some time together, and they decide that they are interested in pursuing dating again, which they have been standoffish about, but because of recent events, they're starting to realize it might be a good idea for them to give it another shot. So around this time, they go to the next day, and they're all hungover, and a planet appears in front of them. It seems to have appeared out of nowhere. They take a shuttle. They're already in the shuttle when the planet appears, and it causes them to crash, which causes Kelly to get out of the shuttle, wanders over to find a young child who, because of her presence, the child runs, trips, and cuts her head. And Kelly, using a dermo scanner, I think they call it, fixes her head. And right then, a group of villagers walk up to see this. And this is a, you know, very pre-industrial society, I guess.
Right.
Pre-industrial is probably, it's almost like a, I forget what they compare it to, the 7th century or something like that. A very early society. And so she runs, and she should not have interfered with the society. They know that. They know better than that, but she did, and they think, no big deal. It's just that one little contact. Then the planet disappears, and then 11 days later, it reappears, and they realize it's going interdimensionally between dimensions, and when it comes back, it is 700 years further in their evolution. It turns out this planet comes back every 11 days, and every 11 days for us is 700 years to them. And so when it comes back, they go down, and it turns out now it's the 1400s era, and it is a religious society has built up around Kelly. And they are cutting people and causing them to bleed. And if they do not are not healed, then they by the magic of Kelly, then they are punished with death for their crimes, or punished for their crimes at least. So that is that's the conceit of the episode. So they jump forward another. Actually, at that time, they go to see, I guess, what is the equivalent of the Pope.
Right.
And they tell him that you're wrong. Kelly is just a person. Kelly used a tool. And they actually convince him. And then he goes to write it down and tell the world what he saw, that Kelly is just a being from a different – that works in a different timeline than them. And he is murdered by one of his cardinals.
Right.
Because that cardinal wants to maintain power. Then it jumps forward another 700 years, and now we're into sort of modern day, and there are televangelists telling the story of Kelly. And then they need to go down and stop it, but they haven't been able to, and they talk about Kelly going down, but they don't think they'll believe her. And so they send down Isaac to be sort of an emissary, since he can live the 700 years, and he's going to stay all 700 years and tell the story of the truth of Kelly. And he goes down, and then 11 days later, they pop back, and now they're a 700 years in the future society, and now they've actually surpassed the Orville, in their, technological advancement, which I thought was funny. They made them glow, I guess, to signify that.
Mm-hmm. And they basically can beam over.
Oh, which, yes.
That was kind of a neat little Star Trek reference.
Yes, I loved that. I loved that they beamed, because they didn't act too crazy surprised. Like, maybe they've seen it before, but it was definitely something that we know the Orville can't do, is beam crew member that way. Crew uh-huh. members that way. So they beam over. They stand there, and they basically say, we don't blame you. If it hadn't have been you, Kelly, our society and our religion would have built up around something else, and we would have had those same struggles and those same sort of inquisition sort of times about something. And basically sort of absolving Kelly of some of the guilt that she feels that would have happened. Those dark times would have happened, but now we've come past them, and reason has won out the day, and religion is no longer really a big part of our society. And then after all of that is resolved, they come back to the ship, and Kelly tells Ed that they cannot be together because Ed tried to cover up her cultural contamination, and she realizes he's risking his command and the running of the ship if they try to be together. So that resolves the sort of personal storyline. And there we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously this is a big episode, and we could do a lot with this. On my other podcast, Superhero Ethics, my partner Jacob and I, podcast partner, we did an entire episode about this, just about some of the ethical questions in this episode, because it's so deep. And I think we're going to have to be kind of a little bit methodical about the different things you and I want to talk about today. So let's just start with kind of like general impressions. I think we both kind of agreed we really like this episode a lot. What makes this episode work for you so well?
Well, I think it asks interesting questions about religion and society, and it just uses sci-fi exactly how sci-fi is supposed to be used. It allows us to see these every 700 year glimpses of the society without in such a cool snapshot, and how small events can interact with the overall like culture and destiny of a people. And I just thought it was a very cool exploration of that. It's sort of a defense of some of the Star Trek ideals of the Prime Directive, but also, a really cool exploration of the interactions of religion and society. And I tend to basically feel the way this episode feels about religion. To some degree, I think it is a very necessary and very important part of a cultural development. And maybe I'm still very much in my my own development, and maybe even personal development. Maybe even every mm-hmm. being needs that sort of thing in their life to help them develop past a certain kind of thing, a certain kind of selfishness. I don't know. Anyway, that's a longer conversation. But in this, reason sort of wins out in their society, and I do kind of feel that way about religion in my own life. So that's where I am. What did you think?
Yeah, I overall loved it. I thought there was a lot of really interesting questions about religion, which I'm sure we're going to get into. A lot of really good questions about what I refer to as the prime directive question, because it's so much what this episode is about. But just that whole idea of what are the ethics of interfering or not interfering with another culture? And as you said, I love the conceit of the 700-year jumps, because to me, in many ways, this is an episode about the idea of the butterfly effect. You know, Kelly does this one small little thing which just throws a little pebble in the water. You know, she thinks it's one tiny person, one tiny family, and one, you know, huge planet. And then we later see the massive effects this has had. And I like the way it plays with that idea, especially going, you know, turning back on itself at the end with this idea of if it hadn't been that, it would have been something else. Let me start with you. There was one note of the episode that I didn't love that I want to maybe just start with, because one of the easiest also to talk about. What did you think of the romance subplot between Ed and Kelly, and how they resolved it?
Well, I personally liked it. I didn't have that issue. I didn't have an issue with it. I thought it was very logical. Often on these shows, there's sort of a contrivance that sort of makes people get together or break up or whatever. And I think that her caring about her career, and even more so Ed's career and the running of the ship, is a very responsible thing to think about. Now, did you not like that he protected her, or what was your problem with it?
No, I mean, I thought his action, I think, like I said, that's kind of one of the next things we get into, is the way he acts towards her. Cause I think they're right that I'm not sure he does the right thing, but I think he does a very understandable thing. And it's a really good question to get into. I guess it is such a trope on show. There's the whole, like, you know, will they, won't they, the moonlighting idea of a show of you create sexual tension and then you keep using plot reasons to drag out the will they, won't they kind of question. And I think you're right that if it was just this show in the context of just this show, this actually gives us a very good, not terribly contrived reason. Her feeling like she still does have feelings for him, and then all the stuff with Derulio has helped them kind of maybe get past the cheating incident and how they were both at fault and they want to try again. But her also realizing that the feelings they have for each other can just make the command much, much harder. It does make sense in that situation. But to me, I think there's two things. One is that the feelings are not going to go away, and so it's probably still going to affect the way he acts towards her. But also, it's just because it is just such a trope that I just kind of always, even though this is a well-done version of the trope, I just cringed a little bit at the, okay, so we're going to go do the same thing. And I remember one of my thoughts was, does this mean we're going to have two or three more seasons of them constantly wanting to be with each other but not being able to be with each other, and maybe they will and maybe they won't? And if I remember, there's less of that in the second season than I was worried about, but I'm not clear, and maybe as we watch those, I'll have my mind changed. But certainly in this episode, I was just like, okay, with an episode that is so good overall, I'm okay with you doing one kind of silly trope-ish thing, but it just felt a little silly and trope-ish to me.
I think sometimes tropes are tropes for a reason. And, you know, this particular one, the will they, won't they is obviously something that's done in 100 million things. It's Gilligan's Island problem of relationships, you know. You want them to be able to achieve the thing that you want for them, but also if they achieve that thing, does it irrevocably change the show? And right. I think this is a season finale, and they wanted some sort of personal stakes, and I think these personal stakes are big enough that I think they will go on to reverberate through their relationship into the future. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think we will have to deal with them doing this some, but you know, this is the first time they've really gone and said, will they, won't they again for this couple. So it just doesn't bother me, I guess. Think that trope, like I said, tropes are tropes for a reason sometimes. And as long as you're not like relying on them too heavily, like, you know, a show like, whatever, Friends with Ross and Rachel, where every season is will they, won't they, and that's what the show is basically about. One of the reasons I like science fiction and superhero type shows is they have something to care about other than just relationships.
Yeah.
In romantic comedies, every once in a while there'll be a career plot line, but like the vast majority of the shows are just basically will they, won't they for every character at with different combinations, which, you know, that's a lot of people's lives in some ways. Mm-hmm. So I can't hate on it too much, but like, I just like the characters having something else to care about. And since for some reason in our culture, just having a career and worrying about that career isn't enough for whatever reason, it's not an interesting plot line to us. Uh-huh. We have to kind of have these contrivances of our career is being a superhero, or our career is being a starship captain. And then you can actually have those discussions, because then it seems life or death and seems like the stakes are high enough. And also the other place we can have it is medical dramas, where that is, again, life or death. So I think that, It is a trope that bothers me when that's what the show is about, but when it's just a little drip on top of a show that I'm otherwise enjoying, I don't mind it.
No, I definitely can understand that. And I think it's not, as I said, it's a lot worse in other situations. It was just a little bit of a like, I would have liked not to see this, but you're right, it's not as bad as it could be. Given that though, so let's use that to go into kind of one of the major questions that comes up. What do you think of the way Ed handles the situation with Kelly, and in terms of kind of lying to protect her and then further interfering with society to kind of go back? And I think that's the next – this may be kind of two questions at once, because it's also about the actions they take with the society. But let's start just with, what's your take on the way he kind of goes against Union protocol to help and protect her?
So I want to say, and I think I'm wrong, I want to say Ed would have done that for anyone. Like it would, like that's what Malloy would say. Malloy would say he didn't protect you because you were dating. He protected you because he would do that for any crew member. And I think that's a conversation that could have been had. Like in that last conversation on the ship, when she says, you know, we can't be together, he could be like, it's not because we're dating. I would do that for any of my crew member. I love you all, and I would try to protect you. He jokes about her being in jail. We don't know how serious this infraction was. The Admiral says the only reason you still have bars on your shoulders is because it was a mistake, and that's the only reason we're letting this slide. Which, you know, that's the thing. Like, it was a mistake. He probably could have told on her, as it were, and not her not gotten in that much trouble. She didn't mean to do it. Now, she did dermo fix the girl's skin, dermo spray or dermo scanner or whatever, the girl's skin. That was her choice. But anyway, my point is, I want to say that, because that would to me build a stronger character for Ed. But there is a flaw in his nature here, where when he was dating that other girl earlier in season one, when he's dating the other girl and Kelly goes against regulations, which her and Alara against regulations, he does report her. He puts a reprimand in her file. And so it seems like there's a flaw in his nature that he actually, like when he's drinking that shot of whiskey at the end, he's realizing to himself, like, yeah, I was protecting her more than I would have been if she wasn't romantically involved with me. And that's something he's got to consider.
I think that's very true, especially in that, I don't think for him it's just the people he's romantically involved with. Like, I think he would maybe do that for Alara, because he feels very sort of big brother protective towards her, and that he might do it towards Malloy because he's very like Malloy's best friend. But I mean, we certainly had an incident where Lamar, you know, when he gets stuck on the planet and Ed refused. You know, the conceit is supposed to be you don't interfere with what's happening on the planet. And it's not quite the same situation, but Malloy refuses to go and rescue Lamar. You know, I think there's definitely an element, although he then hacks into their system and fundamentally changes their justice system, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. I think it's not – I don't think it is quite as black and white as if he has romantic feelings, he will interfere. If not, he won't. But certainly I feel like if he has strong feelings towards a person, he will let those feelings get in the way of the decision he might be supposed to make. And that's because in some level, like I agree with you, if this was a would you interfere for any crew person, then that's a different discussion because then it just is about how much do you or don't you interfere with society versus protecting your own people. But I think you're right here. He's not just making that judgment. His judgment is clouded by how much he cares about that individual person. And this is a very – I think a lot of times people will say, oh, I didn't do it because I cared about that specific person. It was just that I could understand why they did it, and so I was more sympathetic to them. And I think what that idea forgets is you could understand why they did it and be sympathetic to them because you were close to them and cared about them and knew how they thought, knew how they felt and stuff like that. So I feel like it's an interesting example of how this problem can happen, but it definitely does seem like Malloy's thinking on it is a little bit biased.
Yeah. Mercer, by the way.
Mercer. Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, Malloy's the pilot. That's right.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, it just the thing where he reprimanded her earlier in the season is the only thing that bothers me there is just like – it seems like when something is personally attacking him, like in that case of that, like when they're personally attacking the person that he liked earlier in the season, the archaeologist, he like was very quick and it just seems sort of petty. And I don't like that Ed is that way, but I do like that this show allows him to be that way. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I like that for the show. I like that he has flaws. It's the thing we're always talking about, how characters on these shows, especially Star Trek, tend to not be flawed. And Ed is flawed. Yeah. Ed is very flawed. And I love that. I love it.
Like, Picard had flaws, but very much in a... this is Picard's flaw. We're going to have a whole episode or a whole movie about Picard's flaw. Look how big and subtle it is. Look at how big and important it is. He didn't really have a like just underarching, like a subtle in the background thing, but that just would pop up for 30 seconds in an episode and never need to be commented on because it was just something everyone knew about.
Yeah, it's almost like if someone in our society has a flaw, it's going to be a big deal because we're so flawless all the rest of the time.
Right.
Like, in a normal episode, all of our crew members are going to make the morally correct decisions. But if they don't, then we're going to have a trial about it.
Right. So let's now get into this whole question of, and I keep using the prime directive phrase, and maybe you think that's not the most effective model for this. But
I think it is.
Obviously, a huge part of what this episode is about is that same kind of question of what do you do when you encounter a culture that is way behind you technologically. You encounter a problem in the society that you can fix or you can help. But by doing so, you might drastically alter the future of that society. And what do you do? That's kind of a major question that Star Trek went back to again and again. And I feel like this episode, like, yeah, I think we agree. This episode is very clearly trying to be a commentary on that question. So what's your take on sort of their approach to that question?
I wish they were more clear. And part of it... I don't know. I like that they don't seem to – they don't have a word for it. They don't say prime directive.
Right.
They don't have – it's not, and the thing about making it the prime directive in Star Trek is it's not just – and in Discovery, they call it General Order 1. And
okay.
I guess before they called it the prime directive, they called it General Order 1. And in both cases, they're saying this is our most important thing that we do.
Right.
This is this before all other things. This is General Order 1. This is the prime directive. And I wish I wish this show had a name for something like that, but maybe it's not the most important thing. And they call it avoiding cultural contamination in this episode.
Right.
And they talk about how important it is, but I do, it does seem like they have a rule. They haven't been very clear with what that rule is, except for just avoid cultural contamination. But you know, it seems like that should have been a conversation as soon as Kelly stepped off the shuttle. I guess they didn't even know their people yet. I don't know. They do warn her. Isaac warns her not to go down there or to be careful because of cultural contamination, and she does it anyway.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. I don't know. It just seems sometimes like this, the union is not very hard on the regulations, or maybe that's just a Ed's ship thing.
It does seem like they're much more fast and loose, and that there isn't, a military code of conduct or a, you know, union code of conduct. Because the Prime Directive, it's very clear what it is, even though Kirk breaks it all the time.
Right.
But yeah, here, I think though that overall, I really liked this episode's approach to it because, I have a couple of thoughts. First is, and I'm wondering if you had this feeling, in most of the times it's explored in Star Trek or in other sci-fi shows, like a lot of other sci-fi shows definitely get into this as well. But one of the conceits often is that you're dealing with, you know, do you stop a plague that could wipe out a third of the civilization? Or do you deal with some massive injustice that is going to harm a great many people or just one person, but who is going to be put to death for the worst possible thing? Maybe it's because the execution in this episode was a little off, but in this episode, we're dealing with a girl with a cut on her forehead.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish that they had upped the stakes a little bit because they never established that there is going to be any real problem with the fact that she has this, like, you know, okay, it's a pre-medicinal society and maybe there's a chance that she's going to get infected and get very sick or even die.
Yeah.
But they never go into that. They just, I wish that the stakes had been a little higher. That would have at least made me feel a little bit better about Kelly interfering in some way.
We're always doing our rewrite. I'm always loving doing my rewrites on this show. And it would have been better if this girl had fallen because of Kelly's presence. She'd fallen and then had been unconscious and bleeding out or something, like something a little more dire, yeah, like you said. And then she thinks she can get away with helping because there's no one around. She goes to help and then turns around and there's a community watching her. Like that would have been a little better because it just is a lot more defensible on Kelly's part. Like she caused this girl to fall. She's hurt. She's not going to be okay. Like that girl did not look like she was in that dire of a situation. And
right.
That is obviously looking at it from a modern perspective where Band-Aids and Neosporin are a thing, but like,
right?
I agree with you.
But even then, like, people could get cuts pretty regularly, and it wasn't always a death sentence
for sure.
I will say the flip side of it is, and you kind of alluded to this when you were talking about the union and the regulations. Often, the way these things are approached is, you know, someone says, "Oh, should we do this? It would be a violation of the Prime Directive." And everybody has to get around the big circular table or big oval table and have a very big, important conversation about should we do this big thing. And I do like that, at least the way I read it, and tell me if you saw it differently, I don't think the implication is supposed to be that Kelly realizes she's doing a huge violation of protocol and she goes through this very thorough, if very quick, analysis. I think the idea here is that she doesn't even think about it. She's just like, "Oh, sick girl, I'll cure her, no problem." I did like that because I liked the idea that here, this might be an important directive, but it wasn't something that was so foremost in people's minds. Because here it feels like this is, instead of it being about we made this conscious decision, now we have to live with the consequences, this is now instead much more, without even thinking about it, I did what I thought was a tiny thing that had a much greater repercussion. And in some ways, to me, that's much more relatable, you know, because I think like a lot of the times these things happen, that is how it happened. You know, it's a tiny thing that grows into something much more.
Right. And see, I wish, you know, I would agree with you, but the problem is when she comes back to the ship, in that first conversation with the Admiral, she says, "Ed, why didn't you mention the thing I did. Like, she knows it was wrong. She knew it was, she knew it was cultural contamination or possibly cultural contamination. Maybe she thought when it was just a little girl that it wouldn't be a big deal, but that she knows that entire community saw her. And yeah, it does seem like she makes that decision in a snap way. And they don't have the big conversation around the boardroom table, but like, she still knew she did something wrong.
That's
when
true.
She did it. So I don't know. It does seem like there's, I kind of wish this, as much as I think that them playing fast and loose allows for some interesting storylines, I kind of wish there was a little more. We've said multiple times on the show, in this podcast, how that, oh yeah, that crew member should absolutely be fired.
Yeah.
And like, this one is a little more egregious because it's a plot point. Most of the time when we say that, it's because of a joke.
Right.
That the show just wanted to make a joke and it sort of ignored regulations because the joke was funny. And that, yeah. I can, all right, the show has jokes in it, fine. I don't want it to not have jokes in it. But this one is like a thing they hung an entire plot line on, and, you know, she knew it was important for Ed to mention it. And like, maybe it was because she was in that moment suspecting, oh, Ed's protecting me because we're together. And that's, yeah. Maybe she was already foreshadowing that ending.
I can see that being possible. And you're right. Certainly, I wish there'd been more of the consistency to it. So going from that, what do you think of their decisions to kind of try and go back and try to fix things?
We'll see. And then you really get into it, because then you are having that roundtable discussion.
Yeah.
And saying, we're actually, you have a roundtable discussion and say you're not going to do it. And then Ed comes to everybody, throws them the clothes and says, we're doing it.
Right.
Which that has a whole lot of other moral implications. But yeah, it seemed maybe not like the best thing. But the thing is, the way the plot plays out, it's sort of a interesting thing, because they go in to make this big change to the society and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's not like they given most other tropes of sci-fi, I would expect what they do. They go down to try to change it, and they make things worse.
Uh-huh.
But instead, they made a commentary on sort of religion and power and the corrupting force of that. And I liked that a lot. I liked that scene where the cardinal kills the pope, for lack of better terms.
I mean, certainly the guy's hat is straight up a Pope hat. I think it's very much supposed to be what we're supposed to take out of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about Catholicism. I don't know if there's other people who wear hats like that. But yet, I guess this would be their Rome, in that this is where Kelly like was. This is where, or whatever. Not that that's the case in our current whatever. Anyway, in our current world, but like, I guess this would be like a sort of mecca for people, even if they're all over the world believing in Kelly, this would be the right place where Kelly actually happened.
Yeah, I'm very much with you there, especially because, and again, this is one of those things where I think this is what McFarland and the writers were going for, or maybe they just stumbled onto brilliance. But I feel like the entire episode winds up being a real critique of the ego that's involved in thinking, I did this, I can stop it. Because for me, one of the key things here, especially in terms of, you're right, why Mercer decides to make the decision is, and it kind of goes back to the earlier question, as I read it at least, Mercer's main concern isn't that this terrible thing is happening and has to be stopped. It's that he knows Kelly feels incredibly guilty about it.
That's a good
and
point.
And he wants to help her, because and even then I feel like there's a sense to which if they had gone to this planet and just realized this planet had this crazy god idea and they were doing these crazy things that frankly most societies, it seems, go through a phase of something like this, they would have said, this is terrible, but we don't have to interfere. It's because they have this feeling of, we broke this, we have to fix it, which there's a lot of goodness to, but especially when it comes to like intercultural relations or like dealing with things outside your milieu, I feel like there's so much ego involved there. You know, there's so much of, I did this thing and now everything is different and now I have to solve it. And so the fact that the episode, and you're right here, it does take a stand, or at least it reverses the normal stand that people take. the idea that I thought this episode was going to was to say, yes, Kelly did this thing that was the spark that lit this particular kind of fire, but there could have been any other spark that would have launched the exact same fire, and her attempts, once the blaze has gone, to use her particular personage to stop it are completely irrelevant, and even their attempts to use Isaac to stop it, that it's just a fire that's going to happen and is going to burn out. And I really liked that, because I thought it was such a nice check on the sort of great person of history ego story that we so often get.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting that it at once makes this argument that the butterfly effect can cause such a crazy thing to happen, but also in the end it's going to burn itself out. Like you caused, I mean, she caused 2,000 years of damage, I guess, or 1,400 years of damage to this culture. But then it eventually just sort of pittered out, because eventually sort of human reason will triumph as right. Sort of what the lesson, I guess, here.
Well, I guess I take that as part of it, but I think I'm going at something a little different, which is more the – it feels like this is – I always thought there was kind of a logical fallacy of the butterfly effect, which is – you know, at any given moment, 10,000, 10 million butterflies are each flapping their wings. And so, and each of them is affecting things. Mm-hmm. And so how do you look and say, this one particular butterfly, it's the one that's responsible for everything? Because yes, like, if any individual butterfly changes what they do, it probably changes the end result. But they all are doing that. They're all flapping their wings, and they're all having a change. And I think you're right. It shows that it burns out. But to me, I think the overarching idea of this was, if it hadn't been Kelly, then someone else would have done something crazy. You know, that there would have been some other instigating incident, and it might have just been, you know, a young girl who tripped but didn't hurt herself and kind of made up a story about her, you know, fairy best friend who saved her. And that's what the religion got built on. Like, I guess I walked away from it thinking, like, yes, it'll burn out, but also – it's really not Kelly's fault, because this was going to happen one way or the other.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, the details of their religion, the sort of like specifics of, you know, the cuts and all that stuff seem specific to what Kelly did, but like, it's not her that caused the idea of religion to enter the society.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's, it's interesting, because as I say that, it might sound like I'm saying, like, we should never worry about cultural contamination. I don't think that's the case in the slightest. I think it's certainly it's a very real concern and something to always be thinking about. But I like this, just the idea that there's much larger forces in history instead of one person's individual actions.
Absolutely.
So why do you like that moment where the cardinal kills the Pope so much? To use, like, our own terms for their situation, but it was pretty much...
It sort of reversed... You know, it reversed what I was expecting from that scene. I kind of thought that maybe these cardinals are going to take what she said and misunderstand it.
Mm-hmm.
And instead they use that moment to just have a small indictment of, like, giving one man too much power.
Yeah.
Or giving a sort of an upper class of men too much power. I liked it because it was sort of off the rails of the storyline, and it just made a different statement really quickly. And I enjoyed that a lot. Because to me, it would have been easy to be like, Kelly came and she visited, and now this Pope tells everyone that Kelly visited him and blessed his hand, and now, you know, his hand, now he becomes the next, like, big religious figure. You know what I mean? Like, it could have easily gone that way.
Oh, yeah, because then that just continues this great person of history idea of – and you're right, I didn't even thought of it in those terms, but that would have been one more problem with it if it was just, nope, now this person says it, so this person said it, so everyone must be true.
Right, and like, sort of could have easily solidified the power of the church, because there were enough people in that room that witnessed her showing up, her letting him scan his own hand, and he even says, I did that, and she says, yes, using that tool. But I could easily see him misunderstanding and being like, I am the miracle worker now. And yeah. Now, like, I go on to create a bigger society, and like, maybe Kelly is God, but I'm the son of God. You know, that's sort of the thing. And like, I kind of expected her attempts at meddling to double down on what they'd done. And instead it just, you know, because of the natural corrupting power of this, the nature of the religion as it existed at that moment,
right.
One man did a bad thing to maintain his power. And to me, that's actually in my own journey, of religion, which I don't really talk about much, but since we have such few listeners, I'll go ahead and tell all of you, my close friends. I grew up very religious, and one of the biggest things that sort of broke me of my religion is realizing how many of the things I'd grown up with and how many of the things that I was taught were systems of control to keep me believing them. So many things I grew up in the Southern Baptist sort of, and like a lot of it actually is, I still have a hard time, you know, fighting not believing it necessarily, because so much of that sort of fundamentalist sort of religion, there's so much of it that is built on even questioning. I've realized, like, questioning things is sort of, you fear it will lead to excommunication from your community, things like that. And it's just like, I don't, so many things in that are just systems of control. And it just made me feel like a lot of the things I've been taught in my life were just people trying to maintain the power, and not even necessarily control over me, but control over their own lives, because they need this thing to be true.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's a little more nefarious in the storyline, but like, I think that there's a lot of people out there who want to hold on so much to their religion, and they will excommunicate people who don't believe it because they need it in their lives. And if that person that they care about doesn't believe it's true, it suddenly throws into question, it puts this doubting force in their lives. And it's really hard to have those forces exist, in your life. And I don't know, this just reminded me of a lot of the struggles that I went through going through that process, and realizing that a lot of the faith I grew up in, at least, is systems of control that are so many of the beliefs they have are just beliefs to make sure you don't stop believing.
Right. I studied religion in graduate school. I used to be a pastor, as we've discussed on this podcast before. And I had one professor who studied sociology. I studied sociology of religion with him. And he loved to point out that two of the most basic human desires, like on a fundamental biological level, is to eat and to procreate. And almost every religion in the world, I'm not going to say every single one, but almost every religion has at some point in their development had strict rules about what you can eat and who you can have sex with and how you can procreate. And the point being, like, if you can control the most basic biological urges of someone, then you can control them. And it's interesting because I promise listeners we'll get back to the main issues, but this episode did such a good job of raising questions of religion, I think it's worth us discussing.
I feel like that's where we are now. I mean, like, we've covered a lot of these other issues. Let's dive deep into religion if we like.
And I'll say, because I mostly agree with you, but I a little bit defend the guy who killed the Pope, and I'll get to that in a second.
Interesting.
But I'm going to start with just this, is that you and I come to this from radically different perspectives, because I saw a lot of my friends and a lot of people I knew and like people I read about going through the struggles you talked about. And because of that, I was always incredibly grateful that I had the exact opposite of an upbringing. I had an interfaith family. One parent is Christian, one parent is Jewish. And they taught me about religion and about the idea of religion, but were very clear that there was no power structure in my life, that I could find whatever my truth was. And when I was 17, I did find my way to Christianity, but to a very open, like I was baptized by a lesbian minister, and you know the church that I was a part of really welcomed doubt and welcomed agnosticism. And I've always thought there was an incredible irony here, and this is something I often talk about when I get to talking about religion, and this is something I think that the show did so well, is I feel like often there's a sense from people of that like religion is inherently about those power structures. And to me, that's much more about institutions and what humans do with institutions. It's just that religion is so easily susceptible to them. Because one of the things that I find most fascinating when I study religion is that, and I think this show does a great job of showing it, you're right, like power structures will grow up around a religion, and now all of a sudden the priests and the hierarchy and the popes and the rabbis or the imams or whatever you want to call it, they become so invested in protecting their secular power that they'll do anything, including killing people to you know, and as you were saying, to controlling people and teaching them things to control them in order to keep their power. And so I've always thought it's so ironic that if you look at the teachings of the people who have started almost every kind of major world religion or offshoot, you know, and that's Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, Martin Luther, you know, I don't remember the names. I know I've been told this about people from like started like the Baha'i and other kind of traditions. Almost all of them started by questioning the power structures of their day and saying, do we really need this power structure? Can we do something different? And so you're right. I like that this show kind of really gets into showing like how Kelly didn't want this in the slightest. Kelly didn't do anything to start this, but this whole power structure has been built up that has nothing really to do with anything that Kelly did, and certainly nothing to do with the idea of healing. It's just this idea of maintaining their own temporal, like secular power.
Absolutely. So how does that lead to a defense of the cardinal?
Okay, so, and again, it's not, like, obviously he's killing someone, but it's to me, and it also goes back to my critique of Kelly's actions, which I think the show is aware of that I really like, which is, because one of the problems becomes, once people, and I think this is something that I often have a problem with in Star Trek, and I think you and I actually talked about somewhat in that episode of the Orville, all about when, like, the ship that thinks that it's not a ship, and they all of a sudden, like, open the dome to show them space.
Yeah.
Which is the problem that I think here is it's awful to teach a whole bunch of people that the world is very simple and black and white and that everything is strict and rigid and if you follow the rules of the religion, everything will be okay. Like that's a horrible way to teach people and very destructive and causes all kinds of problems. But once you have taught people that, to all of a sudden take that away in a very, like, very, you know, smash it all down, don't provide any resources or ability to help people through the transition, just be like, nope, everything you always thought is completely wrong and bullshit and untrue, that's an incredibly, like, socially destabilizing moment. And I remember you and I talked a little bit about, like, what about all the people who are not expecting to all of a sudden see that the world is much bigger than the ship they're on, what kind of effects it's going to have. I feel like the Cardinal 100% wants to keep his own power.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, I think the Cardinal says something like this, and even if he doesn't believe this, I think it's true. If the Cardinal hadn't killed the Pope, if Kelly had just said what she had said to the Pope, and the Pope had gone out the next day and said, you know what, guys? Everything that we have built our entire world on, every structure of morality, all stems from this one central thing, and that one central thing is false. I don't see any way there isn't 100 years of incredibly destructive, complete social upheaval and falling apart. And that doesn't necessarily justify what the Cardinal does, and it maybe that upheaval and chaos and bloodshed and just total social destruction and rebuilding would have been worth it. But I do feel like Kelly doesn't spend a moment thinking about what that's going to do to the society. And for the Cardinal to think, not only is my own power going to go, but this is going to have massive destructive effects on our society to pull this all away, I don't think it means that he's right to do it, but I think there's a reasonable argument to be made there that makes me feel like he's not just evil.
I do think there is a great conversation to be had there and a great scene to be written there, but they didn't write that. What they wrote was the cardinal saying, it's not only this thing that gives people hope, it also gives them fear, and it makes them fear us. It makes them fear Kelly, and it makes them fear us. It's how we control them. It's how we have power, and that's all he said. But there's a much – going to our going back to our Orville Universe podcast rewrite department, I think that there's a great scene to be had here where the Cardinals could have said, listen – we can't do this. We can't just our society is built on this church. And if we just remove it all at once, that will destroy that. We are what keeps people from raping and murdering and warring, and stealing. We're the thing that's keeping people, keeping the society together, basically.
Right.
And so we can't do it. And then the Pope character says, no, the truth is more important. I don't care. Damn the consequences. I'm going to tell people the truth. Kelly has told me to tell people the truth. I'm going to do it. And then you have this setup where, sort of a religious zealot who's believing in Kelly wants to do it anyway. Then maybe he stabs him and looks sad or guilty about it, but he did it for the people, sort of. That could have been more interesting to me, and a great scene, but that's not what we get. This cardinal, I think, is not morally defensible, even if only because it's his motivations. But you're right, there is definitely something to be said there. Maybe you figure out how to slow roll this information to the people, you figure out how to take away, maybe you start feeling guilty about all the people you're killing in Kelly's name that's the thing. Kelly could have come down and said, listen, all this killing people in my name is not okay. You will be judged harshly by history because I am not real. And I can't tear down your power structure, but you need to stop doing these horrible things in my name. I don't know. Gosh, it's so hard because exactly what Ed says is, what are you going to do? Are you going to stand up there and give them commandments? That's the worst thing you could do.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I'm proposing here. So whatever. I don't know, man.
And the first thing I will say is, you're right to kind of say I shouldn't be thinking about this in terms of the episode, because as anyone who's listened to any episodes of your podcast, the Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast, knows, you and Jeff would never go into headcanon as a way to better explain your understanding of a scene.
Definitely not.
That's just something we never do on either of these podcasts.
Definitely not. We don't believe in headcanon.
Not at all. And you're right. I feel like the way he talks about the people fearing us, I feel like there is some implication of the kind of stuff that I'm talking about.
I agree.
But you're right. It might be that I'm reading that into it and headcanning it. But either way, I do think that's an important part of the discussion here. And it's why and I think the writers at least know this, even if their execution isn't great and how they explain it. But certainly, to me, it's one more example of this idea of, because again, it's that ego thing of, any mess I make, I can fix. If I just go in and say I'm sorry, say I was wrong, say all the stuff that I did, actually it's not true, let me change your feeling of it, then I can fix anything. And that just seems like such a false idea, and I really like how the show gets to that. You're right. Even if I may be headcanoning the Cardinals' actions here a little bit.
Yeah, I also have a bit of a – and it goes back to my own religious upbringing. And I have a real problem of particularly trying to control people through fear, which is exactly what he says. It's not we're trying to teach people to be better people. It's not, but it's just to really dig down on religion here. And what I believe about it, I don't know how to build a society without it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much what this episode's talking about. But I also don't know how to build a personal code without some sort of religion. I don't know how, and I know obviously there are people out there who do it every day. But in my experience, those early years of life, even if it's believing in Santa Claus because he sees what you're doing and like you need to be good for Santa Claus. Like that's still a religion. Like it's this thing we build into children. One of my favorite, there's a band called Caveman's Call. Have you ever heard of them?
No, I haven't.
It's like super, sort of fundamentalist Christian rock from the whatever, like the 90s. But they have a line that I've always just really loved, and it's about the song is about his doubts, and he says, sometimes I fear, and then he like breaks down all his fears about religion. And one of them is, what if this religion is just to harness the young and give some comfort to the old? And I've always loved that line because it's so biting and so it is in very many ways what religion does for people. It harnesses the young and gives comfort to the old.
Yeah.
And like, that's not a bad thing. Like looking at it from my perspective now, that's not a bad thing. When I was young, I was like, oh, that's so indicting because that might mean it's not true. And I grew up in a very fundamentalist, where if it's not true, and I still feel this way, and this is the thing, that's why I like Ed Mercer, is he believes in truth above all else, and right. Kelly does too, and she believes in going and telling them the truth. She doesn't want to give them commandments, she wants them to understand the truth.
Oh, there's so much on that I want to get into when we get into the end of this episode, but let's not go there quite yet. But yes, finish your thought.
Yeah, I just, it's really hard to think about harnessing the young without any kind of religion.
Yeah.
And building a moral code without anything to fear or to desire. I've been trying to do it myself, and this goes for, I guess, not just the young, but myself. I've been trying to build my own personal code and decide what I believe and what I believe about it and how those structures work. And I mean, I've been doing a lot of that on this podcast. Yeah. We've talked about it a lot, but, it's really interesting. The function of religion, not just in building a society, but building a specific human being.
Well, and this is again, I'm going to go into the sociology of religion stuff that I studied, and I'm not like, you know, grand high doctoral student. I just studied it for a couple of years for a master's degree, and would love to hear other people's thoughts because these are just one set of theories that I personally ascribe to. But one of the things that we really looked at in those classes that has really stuck with me is the idea that. And as we learn more and more about child psychology, this is changing and evolving, and I think there is room to find ways where this doesn't have to be the moral development of a child. But that it's often accepted that, like, when you teach a child morality, that there are stages, and that at the very earliest stage, it's, you know, don't hit your brother or else, you know, some bad thing will happen to you. And hopefully for most people now, it's not spanking because we know that's child abuse, but at least, you know, it's don't, you'll have a timeout. Or there'll be some kind of like you said, it, whether it's Santa Claus or it's God or it's your mom, there's some sense of you don't need to know why this is right or wrong. You just need to know not to do this. And that over the course of development, in theory, you should start moving from not don't do this thing because you'll get punishment, but more and more to don't do this thing because it's the wrong thing to do. And at first, even that is still, and you'll feel bad about it. So it's still a punishment of some level, but eventually even that goes away and it's just don't do bad things, do good things. And that in incredibly broad strokes, that's kind of a story of moral development. And here I'm going to talk specifically about Christianity or actually in Judaism as well, because I can talk about this just in terms of Judaism, because it was a rabbi who I studied this with, that if you look at the Hebrew scriptures, that's the exact story that happens over the course of those books. That in the first books, it's don't touch the apple or you will get punished, you know, and then later under the judges and Moses, or then in later King David, there's still the sense of God is watching you. And if you do the bad thing, you will get punished. But that as the histories go along, God becomes less and less of an active player, and more it's you people have to follow the dictates that God has handed down as a general idea, but you have to be the ones to figure out the right moral choices for yourself, all the way to the Book of Esther, which is often in many sort of arrangements the last book in Hebrew Scriptures, in which God never appears at all. So all of this is just kind of a way of echoing that I think you're very right. I think that there's, to some extent, it makes sense that we think of the natural development needs to be, you know, at first it's Santa Claus is real, God is real, you'll get punished, and then we move more and more away from that. And hopefully as a society, we're moving away from the idea that we need that in the slightest, that we don't ever need there's someone watching you and punishing you, that we can start with just, you know, don't hit your brother. It's not a good thing to do. But I think you're right. It really says a lot about what this episode gets into, about the way religions develop and the role that religions play in society. And I say this as someone who is both – it's why I liked the episode, even though I didn't love the ending, and I'll say a word about that in a minute. To me, this one element of the episode felt like the most we're going to go against Star Trek thing that I've seen from the Orville, because so often – like, Gene Roddenberry was very clearly a very ardent atheist, and he very much believed that with science, with logic and reason, all of religion would fall away, and all of religion is useless and terrible and bad and doesn't help. And this episode seems to be postulating more of a sense of religion is kind of a natural part of a society's development and has a lot of problems, but also does inspire a lot of good things and leads to a lot of innovation and helps to build a cohesion support system for a society that I almost kind of got in that last scene where the woman is talking about, like, that they don't look on Kelly as a monster. They think the religion of Kelly was kind of necessary for their society. It almost kind of feels like societal training wheels, if that makes sense, that you get to a point where it's holding you back more than it's helping, but there certainly was a point where it was helping.
Yes, I think that's the dream, and that is what we are. I mean, honestly, that is the transition our society is going through right now, and I think the jury is still a little bit out on what that means for a society, because, like you said, it's part of our personal moral development. But the problem is, if you remove that religion from a society altogether. And I'm making that cardinal argument right here. If you remove even our current society, if you remove that altogether, then each individual having their own personal moral development, especially if you have, which you do right now, a lot of agnostic and atheist people are sort of militant in their belief of that.
Yep.
And they don't want... they would not want their kids going to church. They don't want their kids, you know, being brought up that way. And it's almost like, but what if it's still important for the personal moral development, but the society leaves it behind?
Right.
And that's an interesting question. And I think we're in the middle of it right now. And I don't know. I want to say, because at this point in my life, I don't believe. And I want to say that the truth, there has got to be a way that we can talk about the truth in the same way. And teach people to be better people and be good people and to be morally good, but I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if that's sufficient for a 5-year old to be like, be good. There's nothing watching you. There's no one. There's no structure that's going to punish you. Just be good. Because I've seen kids be real assholes, like real deceptive, really. And like, do they need that sort of guilt and shame of a vengeful God watching them? Like, I don't know. I don't want that to be the case, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly as someone who didn't grow up, like I said, I didn't grow up with any of that. I had no vengeful God idea in my childhood. And the fact that I'm more comfortable with religion today than most of the people I know, because I come at it from a place of questioning, not of like seeking the easy answers. I don't think society is helped by that, you know, the vengeful God that has to, like, I certainly think that it's, there's a need to grow out of that as fast as you can. And I think religion is kind of what I started from the beginning, that I think is not at the beginning, but at some point I said earlier that it's interesting to me that so many religions are started by people saying, you know, stop building exact rules. Listen to what God is telling you in your heart. Listening to your conscience. Listen to what your own understanding of the divine is, and make decisions for yourselves instead of just blindly following rules. I think that, but I just like the idea that and here's what I will say. This is the one kind of sour note for me about the end of the show is I believe that part of what that means is I do think you can have religion that isn't fundamentalism. You know, I think, and I know this is true. I'm part of it. There is a lot of the elements of religion that isn't about there's an angry father looking down on you who will smite you if you're bad, but is much more about, you know, what are the questions Jesus raised? What are the rabbinical texts that we as Jews you can study? What are the, you know, ways to look at the hadiths of Muhammad? And I'm pronouncing that horribly probably, and to any Muslim listeners, I apologize. I probably shouldn't have tried to even quote that at all. Mm-hmm. But just that all of these religions, there are many millions of people who look to them not as fundamentalism, but as ways to give them questions to better understand the world that they're experiencing with science and reason and logic and all of that. It's just those people don't get on television because, you know, no one – I used to joke with a Unitarian friend, you know, no one ever burns a question mark on someone's lawn. Like, it's just you can't yell and scream about being an agnostic and having questions. And so no one pays attention to it the way they do to fundamentalism. I like the way that she says, the woman from that society, you know, that we're not mad about Kellyism. It was an important part of our society. But then she says that eventually, you know, logic and reason took over. And so the religion died away. And I don't think that's necessarily what has to happen. I think what is happening in our own world right now, and fundamentalists, I think, know this is happening, and that's why they're so crazily fighting against this, because I think they know they're losing, even though it doesn't seem like that often. I think the development can become that as we get more understanding of logic and truth and reason and scientific knowledge, that we can stop looking. I've often said that, like, religion is good if you look to it for truth and not for fact. That religion can become much more a source of ethical and philosophical understanding of the world without needing to make truth claims about, you know, here's how the world started, here's how healing happens, here's how these things happen. And that religion can give room to say, no, that's the realm of science. That's not what we do. What we do is philosophy and morality and ethical questioning. And what we do is ask questions. We don't give exact answers. So I kind of – that was the one part of this show that I was like, I wish you hadn't I wish you had sort of said that we'd learn to let religion integrate into our society in a way that was on balance with everything else. Does all that make any kind of sense?
Absolutely.
From a very perspective than what you are.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting. I really want to dive into these questions more as we continue this cast, because I really like we come from such different places and we come from very different places, and we ended in very different places, or we are in different places. I think that both of us are one of both of our tenets, just hearing you talk on the superhero ethics in this cast, and one of my tenets now is trying to be open to continuing to learn. And so I don't want to say that we ended in different places, because who knows what we're going to think in 10 years or whatever. Yeah. Hopefully, I think one of the biggest moral things is staying to me now. I wouldn't have believed this. I wouldn't have been able to say this out loud 4 years ago, or even 2 years ago, maybe. But I think one of the biggest morally important things is being able to question yourself and being able to change and grow.
Yeah.
And that is inherently obviously against fundamentalism, which, you know, believes in this sort of literal perfect, the stuff that's in the book is the truth, and it's the facts, like you said, truth, not facts. Right. I don't know. It's super interesting questions, and I do think that our completely opposite beginnings and current places, I think it's very interesting to explore what that means. And then it means in the end nothing, because it's just anecdotal and about two people, but it's still interesting to talk about.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I think it's interesting just to think about historically, like, the fundamentalism movement as a thing, that started directly in response to Darwin and in response to a lot of those scientific developments, because, you know, I think historically, like, Another professor I studied with loved to use the example of like the Greek myth of Apollo. And they would say that, like, you know, the Greeks had this story that said the sun rises and sets because a chariot, you know, that the god Apollo pulls the chariot of the sun across the sky. And if you were to somehow ask a, you know, a Greek peasant at that time, okay, but do you think that that's really factually how the sun moves across the sky? That question would make no sense to that person. Because the idea that human knowledge could ever understand that wouldn't click. You know, Joseph Campbell talks a lot about this and sort of the power of myth, and a lot of other religious scholars have, that the modern day understanding that we have today, the idea that you can have scientific fact as opposed to religious myth, that kind of thinking didn't really exist for a lot of the people at the time that a lot of these myths were being created. And to me, the most horrible thing about fundamentalism is when all of a sudden you had scientific knowledge that was seemingly disproving the facts of these myths, instead of what I think would have been the much more reasonable response and what a lot of religious scholars did back in the 1800s to say, well, of course, we never thought that this was the actual fact. We think this is a myth that explains it, and we're glad that science can give us facts. The fundamentalists were the people who said, oh, wait, no. If you're challenging the myth, then the myth has to be true. But there's been a lot of great history about this, that a lot of the ideas of fundamentalism of that, you know, it was literally six actual days the world was created in, each of them 24 hours, you know, all these things. Those concepts wouldn't really have made much sense to people other than the last couple hundred years. And so to think that that's always been true, it's just not the case.
Yeah. It's interesting stuff. And see, from a guy myself who grew up in that environment, and you know, I was always taught that that's just the way religion has always been,
right?
And that's what, you know, we're part of the tradition that has continued all of this time, you know. Oh my gosh, I was listening to some YouTube thing. I like watching YouTube videos because they're easy to digest. I was looking for a YouTube video that explained where all of the different offshoots of Christianity came from, like who was first, where did it split off from, like, you know, the Catholics divided into, you know, these different kinds of Protestants, and these divided into Lutheran and this and that, you know, like all the different types. And I was just curious. And then I found a guy explaining it on a whiteboard, you know, and he explains it, and he goes through all of these things and how they all connect and how they all, where this one came from and who this guy came from, you know, all this stuff. And then the very end, he says, but our denomination, we've existed outside of this entire bubble, like this entire tree. We've been existing all the while outside of it over here. This is ours. We're the beginning. Like, yeah. It's like, oh my gosh.
They don't get it.
And that's what I grew up in. I mean, like, I grew up very, very clearly in that. Yeah. I think there are historical examples of fundamentalism in scripture and you know, and a lot of times it's pushed back against, but in some parts of scripture, it's not pushed back against.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I don't mean that way of thinking started. I just mean, like, certainly the term fundamentalism is very much a new term. And that I think a lot of that, the literal fact idea is a much more modern development, but you're right. Elements of it show up earlier.
I don't know this. Anytime you talk about the Jewish people, I feel like is dicey sometimes because of and their history. Anytime you talk about the Jewish people doing a bad thing in history, it's dicey because of our last 100 years of history. But I'm going to say this anyway because I want to clearly state that I am in no way anti-Semitic, and I don't think that this is an indictment of the Jewish people.
Nervous, but go ahead.
Right. This is an indictment of fundamentalism.
Right.
And I was thinking a lot about these questions. And one of the things that pushed me over the edge into realizing that, oh, this is this system. So I've often thought about the Inquisition and sort of that sort of era of Christianity as the time when religion was started to be used as sort of like a weapon. Like it started to be used as a, like, this is the right thing, and we're going to go out and we're going to cleanse the unbeliever. You know what I mean? That's often in my mind when that kind of started. And then I was talking with a friend, and one of the things that pushed me really away from religion altogether, I think, was we were talking about kind of the earliest. I was like, it just seems like when you write it down, when you make it a rule, it immediately becomes a weapon to be used that way. And then I was like, I mean, let's think about it. Like, when was it written down? And I was like the first thing I can think of is, you know, Moses, and they write down the Ten Commandments, and they start to books, you know?
That has nothing to do with, I mean, people were writing down religious tenets, you know, long before
I'm just talking about my specific religion. Like, when was the first time, like, Judeo-Christian ethics were written down? Like, when was the first thing? And I was like, the Ten Commandments, like, Genesis, like Moses and his people sat down to write, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, like all that stuff was written at that time. And then I was like, then it clicked in my head. And then they immediately went around and waged war for it.
Well, but here again, this also goes to my point. I feel like this is one of the times where there's a message in the religion that people, that again, because you're right, the humans who build the power structures want to, you know, I think really kind of, you know, cherry pick what parts of the religion they want people to focus on and what parts they don't.
Absolutely.
Because the part of the story that you're not mentioning is that, you know, the people go to God in the book of Exodus and say, give us commandments, give us rules by which we should live our lives. And God doesn't want to. God says, no, I want you to be moral creatures and to make your own developments. And it's only when they really push that God gives those exact rules and has things written down. And, you know, later, God says, you know, I've given you rules, make your own decisions. And the people say, no, we want to elect our own judges. And so we want God to appoint judges and kings and give us written things down and give us written structures. And then, you know, the same things happens with the prophets. Jesus does the exact same thing. Jesus is always saying, you know, don't write the things down, don't write down the things I say and just quote them verbatim. Make these decisions in your heart. And of course, that's exactly what the people don't do.
Right.
So I guess I'm just saying, like, I think the tension you're lifting up that I agree with, it's not about the Jewish people at all.
No, it is not. That's why I wanted to be clear.
Every culture does that to some extent. And even there, we should talk about the Hebrew people, because the Jewish people is a much more modern conception. I think that it's interesting that there's a tension. And as I understand it, this happens in so many other religions where this need to write it down and to say, and because to me, and I think in actual modern day Judaism captures this much better than most other religions, there really is an art, there really is an aspect in that tradition and faith and culture of, yes, we have what's written down, but we should always be questioning it.
Yeah.
It's written down to tell us, here's what they thought 1,000 years ago. Now we should use that as a guide to figure out what do we believe today. And that I think religion really goes wrong, and Christianity, I think, much more than modern Judaism has done this, and we can have that argument about every religion, but every religion has done this to some extent. You're right, it really gets into trouble when it says, let's write it all down and then look to the book.
Yeah, and that's all I'm getting at. And again, like, I didn't really get to finish it, but like immediately in that scenario, in scripture, it's used as they go in through and like fight for the land they feel like is promised for them.
Right.
And it's not treated in the book as a bad thing. Those people are treated as subhuman, and it's immediately used to other people. You know what I mean? And like, I absolutely nothing to do with the Hebrew people or any of that. It's to do with the idea of writing down rules for what you think is good, and then transposing those rules and saying, like, now, that's more important than my own conscience, and seeing people die in front of me is not going to, you know, click. And I don't know, that's what, anyway, that's one of the, that conversation ended up sort of freeing me of the idea that, like, maybe it's always the idea of writing something down as corrupt, you know, like, it, maybe that immediately corrupts it.
There's a rabbi named Michael Lerner, who I'm a big fan of.
I've heard that name.
He's written, I mean, he's very politically active. He did a lot, especially in the 90s and in the early 2000s, about sort of Jewish social justice. But one of his biggest conceptions is kind of very much what you're talking about. And he actually talks a lot about the Jewish kashrut laws, the laws of what is kosher and what is not. And the perspective he brings is he says, listen, like, and he's just using this as an example about the way we think about sacred law. And his idea is the point of the law is to say that what often happens in scripture is God says, I want you to do this general principle. I want you to be good to each other. I want you to only put in your body that which is sacred. I want you to love your neighbor, you know. And these are general timeless principles. And then the people want more guidance, want more written down laws, and they say, okay, but what exactly does that mean? And so in response, yes, people do write down exactly what that means in that time and place. But then 2,000 years ago, we forget that those specifics were meant for that time and place. It's the timeless thing that's supposed to be coming up. And so, for example, he says, like in the laws of kosherness. And again, I'm saying this as someone who was raised in a somewhat Jewish family and has studied Judaism a good deal, but I'm not a Jewish scholar, and I'm not myself. I identify as ethnically Jewish, but not as religiously Jewish. So I'm saying this very much as a layperson, and one opinion, don't take this as gospel truth, which is an incredibly ironic statement in this particular context, but but just my understanding of it, and my understanding of what Rabbi Michael Lerner's perspective is, which is he's not the definitive either, but I think his perspective is an interesting one, because what he postulates is, if the basic kosher law is supposed to be, don't put into your body is sacred, your body is holy, don't put into your body that which is not sacred, that at the time, knowing what they did about health, shellfish wasn't healthy. The pig, you know, and meat of a pig or meat of, you know, other animals like that wasn't healthy. You know, to cook meat and dairy together, you know, it seems like that it would violate this moral idea of cooking a mother in its own milk, a baby in its mother's milk, that could be like a moral problematic thing. And his idea is that today we can look back and say, no, shellfish is now safe. We know there's nothing wrong with pork. We know that we can mix dairy and milk and meat and have no problem with it. Or maybe you have a moral problem with it, and that's okay too. But then he postulates, so instead the moral law should be about, you know, ethically raised food and, you know, fair growth food and non sort of, you know, factory raised food and things like that. And he specifically says, like, it's not that I'm going to tell you the new commandments, that I'm going to suggest ways for you to think about it, but the point is supposed to be for you to do your own thinking about it. Similarly, in my own tradition, this is a lot of the sort of liberal Christian arguments in favor of things like gay marriage and stuff like that, is to say the biblical argument is just love each other in the ways that you're supposed to love each other. And 2,000 years ago, because people were really stupid, there's a lot of sexist and homophobic ideas, and so they applied those ideas to understanding that law of God. But that we can still understand that law just in radically different ways because we've moved away, hopefully, from that sexism and homophobia and racism and all that. That was quite a long soliloquy there, but I hope that kind of makes sense and ties into what we're just talking about.
Yeah, man, absolutely. It does. It's all very interesting.
Maybe this is a good point of kind of wrapping up now that we both there's so much to discuss for this issue with this episode. And here again, I think this is why it's one of my favorite episodes, is because it just opens so many doors of so many great questions. And to our listeners, to the many hundreds and thousands of you who will eventually find this podcast and listen to our great wisdom, clearly what you should do is take the ideas of Matt and myself, write them down, and use them as the basis of your own moral learning. That's what we're going at here, right, Matt?
We'll be back in 700 years.
Yeah. No, seriously, folks. This is just two people talking about their opinions of just Seth MacFarlane and his own opinions and the writers of this show. Let us know what you think. Here especially, I'd love to get feedback. I'd love to know, what did you like about this episode? What did you not? How did you think religion is something science fiction has tackled so often? Do you think this is kind of a unique take? And do you like it or do you not? Or do you like different takes? What do you think of the way this is approaching the prime directive question? All that kind of stuff. There'll be information at the end of the episode about how to respond and how to get in touch with us. I'd love to hear some thoughts and maybe, you know, tell us your thoughts, and we'll do kind of a mailbag episode about them sometime soon and use that to get back into these conversations.
Yeah, we're actually planning next week to do a kind of season one discussion about all the kind of overarching themes and kind of character development. And so it'd be a great time if you have something you want to talk about that's more general about this first season, get it in, because we'd love to cover it on next episode.
Definitely, definitely.
All right, guys, we'll be back with you next week with that season one wrap-up episode. Peace.
And just remember, somewhere in space, someone's already made a religion about you.
Thanks for listening to the Orville Universe podcast. If you'd like to hear more from Matthew Westfox, search your podcatcher now for the Superhero Ethics podcast. If you'd like to hear more from me, Matthew Carroll, search your podcatcher for the Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast and the Star Trek Universe podcast. Or you can check out my music. Just search for Matthew Carroll wherever you listen to music.